Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Few people I know have more intelligence and a better ability to bring it to bear in real time, particularly on matters involving the jihadist front of the war for the free world, than our first guest. He is the great Andy McCarthy, former federal prosecutor turned pundit extraordinaire. You see him now with regularity at Fox and read his writings, I hope, at National Review Online and PJ Media. You're familiar, trusting, with his many books, including Faithless Execution. And Andy, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Frank, it's great to be with you.
We're conversing, of course, in the immediate aftermath of the latest and one of the most horrific attacks by a jihadist in the United States, namely this fellow Omar Martin. There's, it seems, as ever, a concerted effort underway to obscure who he is and whence he comes and what he's about. Would you shed your very, very clear Klieg light on these matters?
Well, it appears that Martin character is a American-born son of Afghan immigrants who was obviously a jihadist, who appears to have gotten jihadist training somewhere along the line. I don't know that they've uncovered where or when he might have gotten that, but you and I know, Frank, from discussing over the years, that usually the dividing line between successful terrorists and jihadist wannabes is whether they've had paramilitary training or not. I suspect we're going to find out along the line that this guy did have it. And he has committed the worst mass murder shooting and the second worst terrorist attack ever in the history of this country. So I think that, you know, life is not the same today as it was 2 days ago.
For sure, for a lot of people in Orlando, Florida, that's a certitude, and I hope elsewhere across the country, Andy, it should be. And yet, one of the things that we're hearing in the wake of this is that this is a hate crime. This is just another example of gun violence as a result of there being such easy access to guns. As I said, you've been a former federal prosecutor. You've studied closely and written brilliantly for years now about Sharia, the ideology, if you will, that animates the jihad. Give us the straight dope on these two propositions.
Well, Sharia really was set in stone. And Sharia, as we've talked about many times, is not just Islamic law, it's Islam, basically the framework for society and how it's totalitarian in the sense of, central rule by the caliphate. And it's got very draconian punishments in addition to being highly, highly offensively discriminatory against a lot of groups, including homosexuals. And these penalties, these really brutal penalties, were largely set in stone by the 10th century over a millennium ago. So people who are animated by Sharia supremacism, which is a mainstream, that's not exclusive, but it's a mainstream interpretation of Islam. People who have been animated by it have been killing homosexuals for over a millennium, long before there were guns. That may be a surprise to President Obama, who seems to think that, the problem here is guns rather than an ideology that commands the killing homosexuals. But, they kill them. They throw them off roofs. They throw them off mountains. They hang them. They stone them. They burn them. I don't know if President Obama is going to, if we got rid of all the guns, would President Obama be talking about, assault rooftops or automatic stones?
Banning mountains.
I can
see it coming.
But the fact is that this is ideology driven. It really has nothing to do with guns, except to say that if more people had been armed in that nightclub, maybe we wouldn't have had the kind of carnage we did. But I don't want to get into a political argument about guns. I just think it's absurd. We're dealing with a hate ideology that targets Americans and the West. 50 of our countrymen have been killed, 53 others wounded, and we're having an idiotic discussion about guns that is really quite beside the point of what we're dealing with.
It is ever thus, however, when it comes to dealing squarely and honestly with this problem of Islamic supremacism. And again, nobody's really chronicled that better than you with Willful Blindness and the Grand Jihad, among your other works. Andy, there is a development that Breitbart picked up in this story that seemingly ties into one of your previous incarnations as the prosecutor of the blind sheikh. There is a fellow, it seems, Marcus Dwayne Robertson, also known as Abu Tauba, who featured in some form or fashion in the sheikh's entourage, but apparently was a very powerful influence on the shooter in this case, Omar Mateen. And I'm particularly interested in the role that you see of prison recruitment and indoctrination in the ways of jihad. Would you lay that part of the story out for us?
Sure. And what I understand is that they are saying that Robertson was part of the blind sheikh's bodyguard from time to time.
But the point is,
as far as
the role that he played in this episode is you know, closer to today's time for sure. And he was just released from prison, apparently.
Yeah, and the fact that he was and wanted to be self-selectedly was associated with the blind sheikh, who was the leading, even before there was an al-Qaeda, he was the leading ideological figure in the jihad in the world. So, you know, the fact that he had that connection back then speaks volumes. And, of course, we know, Frank, from the studies that have been done on radicalization, that the prison environment is one that really lends itself in a dangerous way to not only, you know, converting young men, especially young African American men, to Islam, but also the very bellicose, aggressive interpretation of Islam.
Yeah, a really chilling thought when people talk about releasing large numbers of these felons from federal prison as part of a so-called criminal justice reform initiative. Andy, I'd like to just finish with a quick thought about what this particular episode, the fact that this fellow Mateen was, among other things, tied to several very jihadist mosques, apparently, in the Florida area, and also a security guard, suggests about the degree to which there's been a burrowing in this country of these jihadists, these Islamic supremacists, and a potential for them to take advantage of an infrastructure in this country, much as their counterparts have in places like Brussels and France.
It's a terrible problem, Frank. You know, look, I think our guard is down. And that is something that's been exacerbated. The Obama administration didn't create the problem, but their hostility to the notion that there is a connection between Islam and Islamic terrorism, such that they basically discouraged not only law enforcement but the nation at large from connecting the two, means that people who would otherwise be taking common sense measures to vet people who come into our country or who work in the types of industries and infrastructure that we need for our security. These guys in Washington say again and again and again, if you see something, say something. But let's be real. The last thing they want, and they're making it quite clear to everyone, is that anybody say something when it comes to Islam. And for that reason, these guys have a lot of rhythm to burrow their way into places that nobody should want them within a million miles of. And the fact that this particular guy did security work for the government is just you know, on one level, it's mind-boggling, but, you know, when you think about where we are, you say, well, what else would you expect?
Yeah, and who else is there? Andy, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I thank you so much for your time today and for the extraordinary work you've done, including two really brilliant pieces at National Review Online just in the course of the past 24 hours or so. Keep up the great work, my friend, and come back to us again very soon. Speaking of See Something and Saying Nothing, we'll have the author of a book by that name, Phil Haney, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I couldn't be more pleased to say on this very important day of introspection and analysis to have with us one of the men I consider to be among the country's foremost, well, not just patriots, but experts on matters involving jihad and those who perpetrate it and why. He is Philip Haney, a career Department of Homeland Security, Customs and Border Protection professional, and a man who has, in the course of his time, witnessed firsthand and challenged efforts by, well, the Bush administration and the Obama administration to dumb down our understanding of the threats we're facing and to prevent him and his colleagues from effectively countering them. Philip Haney is the co-author with Art Moore of a new book that chronicles in considerable detail and very powerful at that, some of these challenges, some of the travails that he experienced. It's called See Something, Say Nothing. A Homeland Security Officer Exposes the Government's Submission to Jihad. Phil Haney, it's good to have you back, though I'm sorry to say it's on this occasion of the aftermath of a murderous attack in Orlando. What are your thoughts about it?
Yes, thank you, and I am sorry as well. Unfortunately, these events bring to light some of the gaps in our systems that I tried to bring to warning while I was still active duty and even now. My thoughts about it, I decided I would go back just exactly the same way that I used to do when I was active duty and to see if I could help connect some of the dots in the case. So to do that, the first thing that I had to confirm definitely was whether or not the shooter, Omar Mir Siddiqui Mateen, actually in fact attended the Islamic Center of Fort Pierce. So after some searching for a total of about 3 or 4 hours, I confirmed, according to two different articles, that the shooter, Mateen, in fact, confirmed by the mosque's own imam, Shafiq ur-Rahman, did attend the Islamic Center of Fort Pierce.
We're talking with Philip Haney. He is one of the country's duty experts on the jihad, a man with considerable experience in government waging the war against it. And Phil, you were talking about some of the forensic analysis that you used to do in government and you've just done on the Mateen relationship to the Islamic Society of Fort Pierce. Please continue that thought.
Yes, it's what I call first-level analysis, just putting all the pieces together on the table and seeing what you have. After I confirmed that Mateen was affiliated with the Islamic Center of Fort Pierce, I went to the Islamic Center of Fort Pierce's own website and found immediately that they are linked to an organization called the Sharia Board of America. Note the name, Sharia Board. Despite the fact we're always told that the Islamic community has no intention of implementing Sharia law in the United States, this is called the Sharia Board of America. In turn, the Sharia Board is directly related to the Rahmat-e-Alam Foundation. That means the mercy of the world, which is the parent organization of the Dar-ul-Uloom Chicago. Dar-ul-Uloom Chicago, just like Dar-ul-Uloom San Bernardino. This is a madrasa that teaches young Muslim boys to memorize the Quran. The Dar-ul-Uloom Chicago is directly linked to my 2012 case involving the Institute of Islamic Education, also in Chicago, including two other Islamic centers, like the one in Fort Pierce, which were part of the which was the case with the 67 deleted records that I have referred to so often in public. And then in turn, all of this, along with 18 other Islamic centers like the one in Fort Pierce, were part of the Tablighi Jamaat case at the National Targeting Center that was shut down by the Obama administration in the spring of 2012.
Specifically, Phil Haney, as I recall, it was shut down by Hillary Clinton's State Department. And remind us why that was done and what might have happened, not only with respect to this case, but the San Bernardino attack, had you not been shut down.
Yes, they were concerned about our focus on this particular group, Tablighi Jamaat, which means the army or the party of promoters, 75 to 125 million members across the world, that we were violating their civil rights and civil liberties, specifically said that, and that since Tablighi Jamaat was not a designated terrorist group, that they were curious why we were spending so much time focusing on that group. And I have that through FOIA documents, too, with Judicial Watch's efforts. They FOIA'd my own case, and that was part of what we discovered.
So to the extent that you were on the trail of these Tablighi Jamaat operatives and had reason to believe that they were, in fact, working to bring Sharia into this country, Phil Haney, what might that have enabled you to do had the investigation not been prematurely shut down, perhaps with respect to not one but two of these terrorist incidents?
Sadly, that's a pretty easy question to answer. We would have continued accumulating law enforcement actions in the case, exactly how we had been for the 11 months that it existed, approximately 1,200 law enforcement cases, refusal of entry, putting people on no-fly, cancellation of visas, those kind of things, exactly what the Department of Homeland Security was founded to do. So now I have two cases, or I should say, two sad examples of what happens when you shut down intelligence gathering operations, a direct link to San Bernardino and a direct link to Fort Pierce.
This is a travesty, and the loss of lives really ought to be, in part at least, on the hands of those who have prevented Phil Haney, you, and others like you from doing their jobs inside the government, blinding them as well as literally interrupting their investigations. Let me ask you about one other thing, Phil. Another group that I know you've followed closely over the years, the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE. This organization, of course, was dutifully trotted out yesterday to condemn this act of violence, as they always do, but refuses to connect the dots or even acknowledge the connection to Sharia and their Islamic supremacist program. Tomorrow, they're scheduled to hold a press conference at which they will be denouncing people like thee and me, I think, Phil, for being Islamophobes and so on. Give us just a quick sense of what the Council on American Islamic Relations really is and how it fits into this larger Islamic supremacist agenda.
This is a known affiliate and known supporter of Hamas, a designated terrorist group since right around 9/11. The fact that an organization with known ties to terrorism has intruded itself into the political process, into the legal process of our country, is to me obscene, because by rights, this organization with several other of its sister organizations should have already been shut down. There is more than probable cause level of adequate law enforcement information to shut these organizations down. And I, for one, as a former law enforcement officer, am really fed up with their constant intrusion into the law enforcement process and into our social political narrative. I think it's about time to really seriously consider reopening the Holy Land Foundation trial phase two and directly go after these organizations, because it was irrefutably proven that they are tied to Hamas. There is no question whatsoever about it.
Yeah. And to the Muslim Brotherhood, of course, of which Hamas is the Palestinian franchise. Phil Haney, I salute you again for your service. I commend you for your new book, See Something, Say Nothing. And I'm deeply appreciative for you taking time on what I know is going to be a busy and very sad day for you. We'll be talking next in a pre-recorded interview we had last week with Mario Diaz-Balart, a man who's trying to designate this Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization, which it surely is. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, an Islamic supremacist engaged in an act of murderous jihad against homosexuals. Such behavior is not just sanctioned by his faith's totalitarian doctrine known as Sharia. It is actually required. But neither President Obama nor much of the so-called mainstream media has deigned to reveal these troubling facts. Instead, there's been much talk about a hate crime and a lone wolf and precious little about Sharia's intolerant attitude towards gays and the jihadism that enforces it. The truth is, unless we get our heads around this reality, while many Muslims want no part of Sharia, those that do, including the authorities of Islam, will increasingly insist that everyone submit to that brutally repressive code, Muslims and non-Muslims alike. If we want to prevent such a horror, we must stop importing more jihadists and roll up those already here. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I'm pleased to say we have pre-recorded an interview with Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart, a senior member of the House Committee on Appropriations, the representative of the people of the 25th District of Florida, and the chief sponsor of very important legislation aimed at designating the Muslim Brotherhood as what it is, a terrorist organization. The timing of this interview means that we are not able to ask the congressman about his thoughts on the attack, but his views on an enabler of jihadism, the Brotherhood, are very, very trenchant indeed. Congressman, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Great. Thank you, sir. It's a privilege to be on your radio show.
Well, the privilege is really ours, because I don't often get a chance to say as direct a thank you as I want to about as important a piece of legislation as I think this bill is. Would you talk a little bit about your sense of what the Brotherhood is about and why it is important to designate it as a terrorist organization?
Frankly, I think the Muslim Brotherhood poses a direct, an absolutely direct threat, a severe threat to U.S. national security interests. They're in essence an umbrella organization, a mother organization of a number of radical terrorist groups. They are constantly attempting to eliminate and destroy not only Americans, but also our allies. And the Muslim Brotherhood has a long history of terrorism throughout the entire world. This is a group that supports and helps and stands behind a number of terrorist organizations that are responsible for, frankly, numerous acts of violence and of terrorism around the planet. So to me, it's pretty much a no-brainer for, it's really, frankly, late. It's time for Congress and particularly the State Department to recognize who these folks are. This is a very well-known group, and sanction them as they deserve, as a foreign terrorist organization. To me, it's frankly sad that we even have to be presenting this bill. This is something that the Department of State should have done on its own many, many years ago.
Not only has the State Department not designated them as a terrorist organization, but has, to the contrary, particularly under the Obama administration, very explicitly been embracing and engaging, in some cases even arming, the Muslim Brotherhood. And Congressman D.S. Ballard, I just wonder, as you look at this, what has the practical effect been of such behavior on the part of the United States government, not just in Egypt, but in other parts of the world as well?
Absolutely, Frank. And I think Egypt is the, I guess, potentially the most vivid example of this administration's lack of understanding of the world. Not only did they, frankly, originally publicly say that the Muslim Brotherhood were acceptable. They supported them. They supported the Muslim Brotherhood, and we saw what happened in Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood started acting like the Muslim Brotherhood does, ultimately the Egyptian people and the Egyptian military, with absolute support of the Egyptian people, were able to, before the Muslim Brotherhood was able to consolidate absolute power, were able to get rid of them, have elections, and through that election process, elect Mr. al-Sisi. Now, I will tell you that one of the most offensive things that I've seen in a long time is if you just read, Frank, the administration's statements, when the Muslim Brotherhood, and they did win originally elections in Egypt, they were the only ones organized and who had the organization and the people and the funding, and they won that first election. If you look at what the administration wrote and stated after that, praising that election and praising the Muslim Brotherhood as if it was the reincarnation of Ronald Reagan, Winston Churchill, and Mother Teresa. And then you read when, after the Egyptian people, with the help of the military, recovered their freedom, had three transparent elections and elected an ally of the United States and of Israel. You should then read that statement, and that is, in essence, a condemnation of this elected leadership that happens to be pro-American, that happens to be probably the best, it's the best relationship that Israel has had with Egypt is now with this current government. And yet the administration, in essence, even though it was a democratic process, in essence condemned Egypt. Again, and we will recall, Frank, the numerous statements from the administration talking about how the Muslim Brotherhood was a secular group and that they were not a problem. Well, history has shown that that is not true. It's hard to not recognize the reality of the Muslim Brotherhood because they have a very clear record. They don't hide who they are.
Congressman, quickly, just tell us where do things stand with respect to this legislation and the prospects for getting a House vote on it as you see it?
Well, I'm optimistic that we are going to get a vote on it. We have two, in essence, impediments. The one that is more concerning to me is, frankly, just is the floor time available, because we have so many things that have to happen. We've also had, which I will tell you, Frank, was a bit of a surprise to me, because when I first introduced it and then I made changes to try to get members of the opposition party, the Democratic Party, to sign on to it and to agree to it, and so I did make changes to try to make it, I guess, less aggressive, even though all that my original bill did was actually speak about the facts. I put the facts in the bill. But if you look at this other version, I have to admit, I watered it down a bit to try to get support. And unfortunately, when it was marked up and, again, we passed it out of the House Judiciary Committee, it was a vote of 17-10, but it was, in essence, a party-line vote, which, frankly, not only surprised me, but was very disappointing. So we can expect strong opposition. I don't quite understand it from the Democrats. I think it's really coming from, pressure from the White House. But we can overcome that. The question is, do we run out of time? I don't think so. I feel relatively optimistic that we will be able to get it through the floor of the House this year.
Hey, before we run entirely out of time, Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart of Florida, let me ask you about one other issue I know you're very passionate about, and that is Venezuela. The complete meltdown of that country that has been propping up the Castro regime and benefiting from its security services support. is of course a blight on the people of Venezuela, but I believe it's also a regional disaster and possibly even a problem for us as well. Very quickly, sir, what are your sense? What's your sense of where that's going and what we should be doing to try to help?
Well, Venezuela is imploding. The leadership there, and as you well stated, it's in essence a puppet state of the Castro regime in Cuba. But the situation on the ground has frankly gotten so desperate that they literally don't have food in the supermarkets. They literally don't have basic things like toilet paper. This is one of, you know, this is, I believe it has the largest oil reserves in the planet. And yet they now are basically down to having 3 to 4, if they're lucky, 5 hours of electricity a day, even in the capital in Caracas. And so the people have hit the streets. They've been demonstrating, but they also then were able to elect a parliament in opposition to the regime, a new Congress. But the regime is just not allowing that Congress to, in essence, do their job. We saw that they literally physically beat up members of that parliament for trying. The members were just trying to do their job, and they actually beat them up. The violence against the Venezuelan people has been escalating. So what should we do? You know, first place, we should talk about and condemn that dictatorship in Venezuela. Secondly, we should support publicly and aggressively by any means possible the democratic opposition, by the way, who have been elected by huge numbers by the people and who are, again, being bludgeoned and beaten up. And, you know, what's frankly very disappointing yet not surprising is the absolute silence from the Obama administration. And so Congress, by the way, has been, that I have to admit, has been relatively bipartisan, has been very supportive of the efforts of the Venezuelan people, of the elected parliament, to regain their freedom and regain their democracy. But again, absolute silence from President Obama and from his administration.
Your leadership in this regard, as in all of these other areas, Congressman Diaz-Balart, is really appreciated. And I commend you for it and look forward to, as I say, both helping where we can and showcasing that work as you go forward with it.
Come back to us again very soon, if you will. Next up, we'll be speaking with Kenneth Timmerman, the president and CEO of the Foundation for Defense of Democracy in Iran. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Ken Timmerman is in the house, I'm very pleased to say. He is the president and CEO of the Foundation for Democracy in Iran, the author most recently of Dark Forces, The Truth About What Happened in Benghazi, and the author of an upcoming book entitled Deception, The Making of the YouTube Video Hillary and Obama Blamed for Benghazi. Ken Timmerman is one of the country's preeminent investigative reporters, a multi-time best-selling author, including of Shadow Warriors, Traitors, Saboteurs, and The Party of Surrender, one of my personal favorites. He was also had the distinction of being nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006 for the work he has done on exposing Iran's nuclear weapons program. Ken, it's a delight to have you with us, though the program today is, of course, being taped under a pall as a result of the attack in Orlando yesterday. Talk to me about what you think that attack should tell us about the state of jihad and our dealing with it.
Frank, let's just put it in a single phrase. Political correctness kills. That's what we've learned here. The FBI interviewed this guy twice in 2013 and 2014 because they had indices that he had contacts with terrorists and had sympathies with terrorist groups. And yet I'm willing to bet you we're going to discover that they were never allowed to ask him whether he believed in Islamist supremacist ideology. They were never allowed to ask him if he had gone to mosques, which they no longer survey. They're no longer watching these mosques because that would be politically incorrect. The president has told us there's no such thing as Islamist supremacist ideology, no such thing as, quote, radical Islam. Nothing there to worry about. Political correctness kills.
Yeah. Ken, you've spent a lot of time in the Middle East over the years reporting and in your various other incarnations. You've talked with a lot of folks, both of the very much Islamist stripe and those who are not. Where does the truth lie with respect to Islamic supremacism? Does the Obama administration have this right or not?
They have no understanding of this whatsoever. They're trying to sweep under the rug an ideology which is not just hateful, it is murderous, and it is widespread. We know in this country there used to be FBI surveillance of several dozen at least, probably more than 100 mosques, because they were recruiting centers for the jihad, for the worldwide jihad. Now, most Muslims that I know denounce and despise this ideology. Most of them have never read the Quran. That's something that we don't understand really in the United States. There are cultural Muslims. The overwhelming majority of people who identify as Muslims are cultural Muslims who really know very little about the ideology of Islamic supremacism. And there's nothing, you know, those individuals do not pose any threat to anybody, but they are not the people that we're worried about. The people that we're worried about are those who have adopted this ideology, are practicing this ideology, and are looking for opportunities to kill us.
Yeah. And to the extent we're ignoring that reality at the highest levels of the U.S. government, obviously it's putting us at greater risk. And Ken, you've particularly been studying and worrying about Iran. I want to talk with you about it and, if we could put them together, the sort of counterparts, if you will, in terms of their Islamic supremacist ambitions, the Muslim Brotherhood. The extent to which the Obama administration has been, well, submitting, I guess is the technical term to it, to the Brotherhood on the one hand and the Iranians on the other, we've seen very, very profound and dangerous repercussions. Talk a little bit about Benghazi, and then we'll talk about the Iran nuclear program.
Well, first of all, remember, the Islamic Republic of Iran is actually the first Islamic state. All right. They are the Islamic State of Iran. Let's not forget that. They have adopted the Quran as part of their constitution. They have proclaimed jihad as part of a duty under their constitution. And they have set up an organization, a military terrorist organization, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, to export the revolution, to export jihad and Islamic supremacist ideology. So they are really just the other face of the Islamic State, ISIS, and the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the breeding ground for ISIS operatives. The Muslim Brotherhood frequently gets a pass, especially by this administration, because not everybody in the Muslim Brotherhood is preaching violent jihad. They're preaching maybe nonviolent jihad. You got to remember, when they preach nonviolent jihad, it's merely because the opportunity for violent jihad is not there or not necessary. It's just a matter of tactics and timing. That is the only difference between the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah, this is why I call it the pre-violent approach, not so much non, but pre-violent. They call it civilization jihad. But to the extent that we've got both in Iran and in the various outcroppings of the Muslim Brotherhood, evidence of this Islamic supremacist agenda, how serious a threat do you think it represents, not just to individual Americans, but to our country and indeed, for that matter, the free world more broadly.
Well, it's a huge threat, Frank, and it's made greater by the fact that the administration has closed its eyes to it completely and has allowed Muslim Brotherhood operatives not just to infiltrate, but they have promoted them in the government, in law enforcement. They have allowed their agenda to dominate, their agenda, for example, to dismantle the kind of programs that Phil Haney was involved with that would have identified potential terrorists before they became a threat. So, yes, this is a huge, huge problem, and we really need to get our arms around it. Donald Trump has understood this very well when he says that we, for now, until we have the programs in place, which have been dismantled, we cannot allow any more Muslim immigration into this country because we've dismantled every intelligence program and every law enforcement program to separate the weak from the chaff, if you wish, or the violent from the pre-violent and the nonviolent.
Yeah, particularly the ones that are not a problem, as you say. And Ken, I know you've written one best-selling book, Dark Forces. Again, our guest is Ken Timmerman. You've written one best-selling book, Dark Forces, The Truth About What Happened in Benghazi. You have another one coming out momentarily entitled Deception, which also talks about a very important aspect of this Benghazi drama, namely the video fraudulently blamed for precipitating the attack there. Just in a nutshell, talk, if you would, about what you found about Benghazi and what we may not learn from Trey Gowdy's committee when it puts its report out.
Yes, we will not learn about what's in my new book, Deception, because he has not investigated the YouTube video that Mrs. Clinton and the Obama White House blamed for the attacks. And this book is entirely devoted to that, how that video was made and how the White House and the State Department are responsible for promoting it. Nobody would have seen it, and nothing would have happened around the Middle East after the Benghazi attacks had the White House and the State Department not promoted Innocence of Muslims, this YouTube video. Nobody had seen it before Benghazi. It had zero relationship to the Benghazi attacks. As I track in the book, the website that the first journalists who were told to direct their readers to this YouTube video, the YouTube channel they were told to look at had 405 views the morning after the Benghazi attacks. Nobody had seen this video.
Ken, hold the thought. We're going to come back for a second segment with Kenneth Timmerman, the president and CEO of the Foundation for Defense of Democracy in Iran and the author of Dark Forces, The Truth About What Happened in Benghazi. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're visiting with Kenneth Timmerman, colleague, a friend of many years, a very highly acclaimed and accomplished investigative reporter, author of myriad books and countless articles. He is known particularly for one most recently, Dark Forces, The Truth About What Happened in Benghazi, and he will be, I believe, well known for the one that is forthcoming, Deception, The Making of the YouTube Video Hillary and Obama Blamed for Benghazi. And finish the thought, if you would, Ken, that you had about the fact that nobody had seen this YouTube video, and yet the administration did everything in their power to, well, I guess put it up in lights, is the Hollywood term for it. What was that about, and how did it fit into what they were trying to do in the way of damage control on Benghazi?
Well, here's the thing. A number of lawsuits by Judicial Watch and other organizations, we now have access to new documents, to emails, to transcripts of Hillary Clinton's discussions with foreign leaders at the time of the Benghazi attacks. And we know Now, and I lay that out in great detail in the chronology of how this happened. We know absolutely that the State Department, that Hillary Clinton knew there was no relationship between the YouTube video and the Benghazi attacks. Zero, nothing, nada. And yet, they went out in public and lied to the public to focus attention on this YouTube video, the innocence of Muslims, and to smear the people who were involved. I mean, part of my new book is really a human interest story about one of the actresses whose life was completely destroyed. She was identified by the Secretary of State and the President of the United States as being responsible for the deaths of four Americans. I mean, it was a pretty heavy thing. And they tried to kill this woman when she came to Washington, because by this point there was a jihadi cleric in Egypt who had issued a death threat, a fatwa, obligating Muslims, faithful Muslims, to kill her. Not suggesting that they might, obligating them, saying it is your duty to murder anybody involved with this film. But we know now from all the documents, Frank, it was a complete put-up job. They were trying to get the public to focus on something that fit their ideological agenda of having anti-blasphemy laws in this country. And that's another thing that I talk about in Deception.
The role, I trust you will also be exposing, of others in addition to the Secretary of State and the President, like Huma Abedin, the Secretary's right-hand gal, and Rashid Hussein, the President's envoy, as he called him, to the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. These are people who have been deeply invested in the Islamist or Islamic supremacist agenda for a long time. And I fear that but for the kind of exposure that you're giving to it, we will allow this process of subordinating our freedom of speech to what some call political correctness, what I think of as you do, to go forward apace. It's a very frightening thought. So keep up this good work, my friend. Let me turn to one other topic with you, Ken. Egypt Air, you've been writing about how it came to be destroyed and what it might tell us about the kind of challenges we're facing from the infrastructure that the Muslim Brotherhood and so-called pre-violent jihadists have been putting into place here as well as elsewhere.
Well, one of the things that the French discovered, and they discovered this before Egypt Air, they discovered it after the Paris attacks in November of 2015. They found that there were something like 50 individuals who had access to the aircraft on the tarmac at the Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris, the main airport in Paris. They discovered 50 of these individuals also had ties to terrorist groups, had ties to ISIS, and they pulled their security passes at that point. But what they started to look into was, oh, gosh, did we miss some more? Because early in their investigations of the Egypt Air flight, they really did focus in on the possibility that either a bomb was placed on the aircraft at Paris while it was in Paris on the stopover, or that somebody was on the aircraft who was able to either fire a weapon or something else because there was an attempt. So that's something that, you know, we've seen this in this country, in Minneapolis. They discovered that there was somebody, an individual who had family members who had volunteered for jihad, had access to the airport and to the aircraft at Minneapolis Airport. We don't know how many others because, again, the Obama administration has dismantled all those programs. You know, that's politically correct.
Anybody traveling through airports around this country, Ken Timmerman, can attest to the visible signs. And it's not to say that all Muslims are a problem, but those who basically embrace Sharia and are willing to, in the case of women notably, cover themselves from some cases head to toe, and in other cases men, you know, with their beards and so on, evincing a conformity with Sharia's dictates, that is a problem, it seems to me. So your reporting on this is really appreciated. Hey, Ken, lastly, let me turn to this question of Saddam Hussein and weapons of mass destruction. There is, as you know, now a renewed debate about whether it was advisable to go into Iraq or not. The Republican incipient nominee for the presidency, Donald Trump, has, you know, reminded us that that he felt there was no such evidence. What is your take on the truth about Saddam's programs and capabilities, and whether it was advisable, for that matter, to try to take him out?
Well, look, the media lied, and Donald Trump did not do his own investigation on this. So he basically repeated the lies in the media, and I'm assuming that once he gets access to the intelligence, which the Bush administration had and never defended, by the way, they allowed the lies to be repeated and repeated and repeated by the media, I'm assuming that he will change his view on Saddam Hussein and his very active chemical weapons programs, his very active biological weapons programs, his very active nuclear weapons programs. People seem to forget that 5 years after the liberation of Iraq, the United States helped the Iraqi authorities to send to Canada a 500 tons of uranium that didn't exist because there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, right? 500 tons. It's spectacular the way that the media has you know, perpetrated this lie and pounded it in the American public. There were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Yes, there were, and we found them. We were finding them and keeping. We kept on finding them year after year after year in Iraq.
And as you point out, Ken Timmerman, in some of your writing on the subject, even the now director of national intelligence acknowledged that there was evidence that the Iraqis were moving stuff into Syria shortly before the invasion. And there's some speculation that that included weapons of mass destruction programs. Do you think that the Islamic State has gotten access to some of that stuff and used it?
I think absolutely. And we've seen this on the ground. Remember in 2013 when President Obama blamed the Syrian government of using chemical weapons against its own people? Well, the evidence on the ground showed that it was probably ISIS that had mistakenly released chemical weapons agents. Look, ISIS is what, Frank? ISIS is the combination of radical jihadis, al-Qaeda-type folks, and the bossist military intelligence stay-behind apparatus. I wrote about this 5 years ago. I had to write it as a fictional account called St. Peter's Bones. But that is what ISIS is all about. I have interviewed people who are very close to the stay-behind network who admitted, absolutely. So you have the bossist military establishment who know exactly where these caches of WMD material that they left behind are located, and they've given that to ISIS. I think it's just a matter of time before they pull all of that stuff together and use it more. There have been many reports of them using chlorine gas and other stuff in northern Iraq.
Yeah. We'll be following this closely, as I know will you. Kenneth Timmerman, of the Foundation for Democracy in Iran, the author of all of these books, including, I'm glad you mentioned, one of my favorites, your novel, St. Peter's Bones. Ken, keep up the great work you do, my friend, and come back to us again very soon, if you would. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.